Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 491. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. I'm delighted to be back with you today. I feel like I've been kind of cast back in time because something's wrong with my voice, and I keep it keeps cracking, so no doubt you'll hear that once or twice in this interview. I'm living as a middle schooler, so you have a young one leading your conversation today, but I'm joined by an old man, a dear old soul, Jim Cassidy, who is the pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to have you. You could be my brother. We're close enough in age, but I thought I'd give a jab in there.
Being led by young boys, that sounds like a prophetic curse, doesn't it?
Something in Joel 2 about this, maybe. I don't know.
Isaiah 3, something like that. Right.
Your young men will prophesy. We're joined with a young man today, a very bright mind, though. We're very pleased to welcome Will Wood, who's a PhD student at Westminster Theological Seminary, studying Old Testament. He's been on the program before, talking about the biblical theology of clothing. Today he's going to talk about another very important subject. Welcome back, Will. It's great to have you on again.
Hey, Camden. Thanks for having me back.
Anytime. We're delighted to have you. We got a lot of great comments about our last conversation with you. A lot of people were very interested in the paper that you wrote on a BT of clothing, and I thought it was very insightful and stimulating. We enjoyed, as Lane Tipton might say, the fecundity of your of your paper. And today, we're going to speak about another one, talking about the role of Ephraim in Judges, or as I like to say, Ephraim. And it depends on how you want to pronounce your Hebrew there. Will's written an interesting paper. This was just for this semester, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Hot off the press. So hopefully we can get it published somewhere. But we're happy to have this paper before us and to talk about this important subject. Jim and I have both preached through the book of Judges, and so we'll try to knock off some of the rust on that in our minds. But be sharp as we ask Will some insightful and interesting questions about this important book and the role of one of the tribes of Israel. But before we get to that, we do want to mention a few things. Of course, Christ the Center is listener-supported, and we do rely on the support of all of our listeners and viewers to help us produce and distribute all of these programs free of charge. We love the freedom that you, the listener, have given to us. By supporting us, you free us up so that we can do what we love to do, where we can produce resources for this very targeted segment of the world, and people are growing, and more people are coming to the website to listen and to learn more about this wonderful Reformed tradition that we have and that we seek to advance. So if you are able and willing, please visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. And I do want to thank everybody for helping us out and for listening and supporting us here at Reformed Forum in this program, Christ the Center. I do also want to say that if you visit us online at the website at reformedforum.org, we do have a banner working right now which shows our new book, No Uncertain Sound. It features that, and if you click on that banner, you'll end up at a page which has links to purchase the book at a variety of locations, one of which, and the best price, is at WTSBooks.com. So if you visit WTSBooks.com, you can throw our book in the cart and bring it home. So we would love to hear more about the people that are reading the book and having feedback. So if you'd like to get a hold of us, you can send us a note at mail@reformedforum.org. You can tweet us at Reformed Forum, or you could just hashtag Reformed Forum or No Uncertain Sound and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear it. Jim, have you received any further feedback about the book? I know some people down at your church have been digging into it, and I've certainly handed out more than my share of copies.
I've received a couple of words of appreciation from folks. Adam Ostella, friend of ours, up there in Michigan, had contacted me expressing his appreciation for the volume and for the articles contained in it. So yeah, we're trying to, I'm trying to encourage people to go ahead and read it, trying to get as many copies as I can into the hands of people who would be interested. By all means, please pick up a copy and then interact with us, because that's one of the things that we really enjoy, really at the center of our work and mission here at Reform Forum, Camden, is to make this a venue, a forum in which we can have good theological, rich theological discussion, conversation with listeners and other believers and brothers in the Lord throughout this country and throughout the world, in fact. And so please do read and then reach out to us. So we'd be happy to interact with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the book is a very specific thing. We're this is why we published it ourselves, because we enjoy being able to be focused and to produce a resource that is targeted exactly towards our listeners and our readers and the people that we're trying to reach. And we want more and more people to read and learn and understand. And so the book is written at a level where, you know, an informed layperson can read it and grow and understand. It's not a doctoral dissertation or anything of the sort, but it has a lot of helpful resources, and it'll get you on track to learn more and to grow more by engaging in more of what we do. At the end, there's a helpful reading list, suggested program for people to work through. So even if you just want to get the book for that, I would say it's pretty handy and useful. So enough of that. We want to thank everybody for their support. Get in touch with us. But today we're talking about the Old Testament and going to be speaking about the role of Ephraim in the book of Judges. Many people might not know, but certainly as you write here, when we approach the book of Judges, people look at Ephraim and they generally have an anti-Ephraimite stance, or at least they believe that Judges is against Ephraim and has nothing good to say about Ephraim. When did you become aware of that, and when did you start to question kind of the reigning dogma in this department?
Yeah, well, the paper kind of started by me just reading the book of Judges and asking the question, what's the deal with Ephraim? You know, it shows up in so many different narratives throughout the book of Judges, from the prologue all the way to the epilogue. And so I was kind of wondering, you know, what's going on with Ephraim here? So I started doing a little bit of digging, and I came across a lot of comments. Daniel Block would say that, you know, an anti-Ephraimite stance in the book of Judges is irrefutable, or how Judges has nothing positive to say about Ephraim. And as I was reading Judges, I couldn't help but think that wasn't actually true. So I started, you know, digging into it a little bit myself and looking at the different narratives and trying to see how Ephraim is being referenced throughout the book of Judges. And what I found as I was analyzing the narrative and looking at these different things is that although there are negative things about Ephraim in the book, there's also some other positive things. And part of that is because the book of Judges is kind of structured that way itself. You know, Judges is structured to where it's a downward spiral from generation to generation of sin and rebellion against the Lord until it kind of reaches rock bottom by the epilogue. And so as I was looking at it, what I wanted to do is tie the tribe of Ephraim in with this downward spiral. And by doing that, I think we're being a lot more true to what the book of Judges is trying to do in general, and then what it does with Ephraim in particular.
Why is Ephraim considered particularly in the book? What features of the book or treatments of Ephraim, why do they stick out, and why are people so negative on Ephraim versus other tribes, for example?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the general consensus among Judges scholarship of a previous generation that what the book of Judges does is it sets up a polemic against the northern kingdom in support of the southern kingdom. And so since Ephraim in later biblical books is used as kind of a catch word for the entire northern kingdom, then what they're saying is that Judges is a polemic against the northern kingdom in response and then promoting a pro-Judah stance and an anti-Ephraim stance. I think especially of a guy named Robert O'Connell, who's the big proponent of this thesis And one of the legs of that thesis is that Judges has nothing positive to say ever about Ephraim, the representative of the Northern Kingdom.
Why don't you sketch for us a bit some of the history of the tribe? I mean, going all the way back to Genesis, who was Ephraim? And what role does this tribe have throughout redemptive history? Perhaps that'll provide a helpful historical background for us as we consider specifically their role in the book of Judges.
Yeah. Well, I'll say that the thesis of my paper is that by the end of Judges, so once Judges goes through this downward spiral, the various blessings that are promised to Ephraim in earlier books, in earlier redemptive history, are reversed. And what those blessings are really begin in Genesis 41. Now, Genesis 41 is where Ephraim is born. And Ephraim, the name, means fruitfulness. And Joseph names his second son Ephraim in Genesis 41:52, saying, "Because God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction." So the name Ephraim, and therefore the tribe of Ephraim, is tied together with this concept of fruitfulness. And I think that fruitfulness is tied especially in relation to progeny. Now, you think if you read the book of Genesis, just, you know, Genesis 1 all the way to the end, then the book is primarily concerned with progeny and the promise of, you know, children coming from, you know, Adam and eventually all the way down through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And Ephraim is part of this promised progeny of the Lord. And so Ephraim's name is tied to Ephraim's fruitfulness and a fruitful progeny. But also in Genesis 41, which is important for later when we're talking about Genesis 12, Ephraim is tied also with fruitfulness in the land. So we have Ephraim meaning, you know, particularly a fruitful progeny, having a lot of sons, and also fruitful produce and a fruitful realm. So that's some of the major things with Ephraim beforehand. And those threads play out in other texts like Genesis 48, Genesis 49, and Deuteronomy 33, where Ephraim receives patriarchal blessings. Like in Genesis chapter 48, where Jacob blesses in particular the sons of Joseph, which are Ephraim and Manasseh. And if you remember from that narrative, the blessing is what? It's a fruitful progeny.
Mm-hmm.
It's that Ephraim will receive sons and daughters, and they would have, you know, that they would be fruitful and multiply, like Adam was commanded to in the garden. But also in Genesis 48, one of the particular aspects of Jacob's blessing is in verse 20. You know, if you remember the narrative, what happens is, you know, Joseph brings his two sons to Jacob, his father, for a blessing. Manasseh is the eldest son and Ephraim the oldest. And Joseph is very particular to set up a context where Manasseh will have the right hand of Jacob placed on his head to receive the primary blessing. But what Jacob does is he crosses over his hands and he blesses Ephraim with the blessing of an elder son and Manasseh with that of the younger. And he says, "Thus Jacob put Ephraim before Manasseh." And I think what that does is it reminds us of another episode in the book of Genesis where the younger son is put above an older.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in Jacob's own life between Jacob and Esau. And I think what that does is it invites us a comparison that comes to the forefront in the book of Judges of what is going to happen with these two tribes that descend from Ephraim and Manasseh. And I don't want to tip the hand to it yet, but it becomes really important when Manasseh begins to subvert Ephraim later in these two tribes' history.
Mm.
So Jacob promises Ephraim a fruitful progeny, especially Genesis chapter 48. You can go read verses 15 to 16 and 19 to 20, and especially a progeny, a people greater than Manasseh. Now, another thing, you know, those threads come back again and Genesis 49, where Jacob blesses all the tribes, all of his sons, and also Deuteronomy 33, where Moses blesses all the tribes of Israel. Now, I don't want to rehash those two blessings. I want to point out one more thing from those two texts that are important. And it's that Jacob, when he's blessing all the sons, and Moses, when he's blessing all of the tribes, places Ephraim in an important position. In fact, both of them repeat the phrase that Ephraim is a prince among his brothers. So Ephraim's being placed in this preeminent position. In fact, if you're reading these things, all of these blessings side by side, Ephraim is second only to Judah. So Ephraim is being put in this preeminent position. He's promised a fruitful progeny, especially a progeny greater than Manasseh, and he's promised a fruitful realm that he's going to dwell in. And it's these three things that I argue are ultimately reversed in the book of Judges.
Interesting. So moving into the book of Judges itself, would you be willing to take us into the prologue and the way in which Ephraim plays a role there within the prologue of the book?
Yeah. And before I do that, I want to say, you know, Judges isn't the most popular book in the world. So if anyone out there hasn't read Judges in a while, go read it. That'll definitely help, you know, set the context for everything that we're about to say. Yeah.
You don't have a lot of Christian bookstore calendars or cards that say, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Yeah. Not a very uplifting quotation.
No, it's not.
Not inspirational at all.
No. Yeah. And so go read it and pay attention. That'll kind of set the context for everything that I'm about to say. But the prologue of Judges is organized into two parts. I call them just prologue one and prologue two. And the first one extends from verse one of chapter one to chapter two, verse five. And in this first part of the prologue, there's two different elements. The first one is kind of a summary narrative of the conquest of the land. So if you're reading through Judges 1, you get this sort of terse history of the tribes of Israel going in and making war against the Canaanites. But there's also these other sort of mini narratives interspersed. So if there's this broad narrative of the tribes of Israel going and making war, then there's these shorter narratives where the narrator zooms in and looks at particular episodes. And both of those work together with Ephraim in this first part of the prologue from 1:1 to 2:5. Now, the summary portion of Israel's conquest of the land presented in this first section of the prologue is actually organized geographically. It's organized where it starts with Judah in the south, and then it progresses to a migrated Dan in the north of Israel. And as it goes through this south to north trajectory, there's a decreasing success in conquering the land of Canaan. So, for example, Judah in the first part of this first section of the prologue is successful in conquering their territory as Judah and Simeon go up together and they conquer their land. As the narrative moves forward north, we reach tribes like Ephraim. And Ephraim, in some episodes, we'll look at one in particular here in a minute, is successful. They conquer a city called Luz, eventually rename it Bethel. But also there's an aspect where they're unsuccessful. They lose at another city. Verse 29 of chapter 1, Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. So Ephraim, if you don't know your Bible atlas, which most of us don't, is right in the middle of Israel, right in the middle of the land. And so in this south to north trajectory where they're losing ground in the promised land, Ephraim is right in the middle where they have some success and some failure. And I think that invites us a comparison with the main narrative of the book, where Ephraim is going to be seen as having some positive characteristics as well as some negative ones. But beyond that overarching kind of south to north trajectory, there's also two mini narratives in this prologue that concern the people or the tribe of Ephraim. And the first one's in chapter 1, verses 22 to 26. And the second one is in chapter 2, verses 1 to 5. Now, chapter 1, verses 22 to 26 is probably the more important one. Because what we have here is an episode of what I call throughout my paper, intertribal cooperation.
Hmm.
And what happens in chapter 1, verses 22 to 26 is that the house of Joseph works together to conquer this city, Luz. And in fact, this episode is very similar to how Joshua leads the people in conquering Jericho. So, you know, have that sort of narrative in the background here. So this house of Joseph is a reference to Ephraim and Manasseh together. You know, these brother tribes working together to conquer this city of Luz. And I think that this is an ideal situation in the book of Judges, that the people of Israel were meant to work together to conquer the Canaanites. In fact, just in the preceding narratives in chapter 1, verses 4 to 7, when Judah is successful in the south, they do it with the cooperation of Simeon. So even there, there's an episode of intertribal cooperation where they're working together to defeat the Canaanites. Now, an interesting observation is that these two episodes with Judah and Simeon together and Ephraim and Manasseh together are the only times in the whole prologue of the book of Judges where the Lord goes with the people to give them victory. Hmm. So I think that's a way of the narrator illustrating for us that the manner that Israel was meant to go forth and make warfare against the Canaanites was as one people. They were meant to work together as the people of Israel, all the 12 tribes together, to conquer the Canaanites. But as we will see in the main body of the book of Judges, what ends up happening is that intertribal cooperation begins to disintegrate. The tribes stop working together to defeat their Canaanite neighbors. Now, do you have any questions about that one?
Well, that would definitely seem to comply with the refrain that everyone doing what is right in his own eyes. Certainly every tribe starts to do what's right in their own eyes, but it even goes further than that, where tribes seem perhaps even to disintegrate down to the individual. There's this progressive unraveling throughout the book.
Yeah, and by the time we get to Jephthah, we can make this point more there. His response to Ephraim when they confront him for not calling them out to join him in war, he says what? I and my house. Now, he was emphasizing the point that I'm here to do this for me. This doesn't concern you.
Yeah.
And so his retort against Ephraim is, leave me alone. I don't want any tribal unity to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And so the tribes not only stop working together, but as I'm sure you'll get to later on in the book, they begin to, it's even worse than that, right? They begin to bite and devour each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is exactly what happens in Judges 12.
Indeed.
But then there's also this second little mini narrative in chapter 2, verses 1 to 5. And what happens in chapter 2, verses 1 to 5, is that the angel of the Lord, who's currently residing in Ephraim, picks up his camp and moves over to the newly conquered Luz, or Bethel. And this move from east to west, arguing in the paper, is actually an aspect of the book of Judges that hasn't really been brought out before. You see, if the overarching conquest narrative in Judges chapter 1 is on a south to north trajectory, then this east to west move of the angel of the Lord introduces a second axis, you could call it, into this geographical reference point. And I think that's important for the rest of the book, because what we're going to see is through the main narratives with Ephraim, what ends up happening is that Ephraim moves further east away from the presence of the Lord across the Jordan River. And as they move further east across the Jordan River, they simultaneously move further north along the Jordan River. So if the south to north trajectory in Judges chapter 1 presents a context where Israel is more and more failing to do what they're commanded to do in destroying the Canaanites, then that south to north trajectory has a correspondent east-west one illustrated by the tribe of Ephraim. And I think what that does is it ties together an all-Israel illustration point. So it's all of Israel together, whether in the north or the south or the east or the west, that is disintegrating and becoming more and more like the Canaanites. Because really, by the time of the prologue, Israel is described in terms that are a lot like Sodom and Gomorrah. They're described like their Canaanite neighbors. So what the prologue does with these two mini narratives and with this overarching south to north trajectory is it gives us a context to see the rest of the book. It gives us a context where we're going to weigh the work of Ephraim and the main body of the book against these things that happen in the prologue. Now, that's just 1:1 to 2:5. Now, the second part of the prologue from 2:6 to 3:6 doesn't really mention Ephraim, besides it being the place where Joshua ends up being buried. Remember, Joshua is from the tribe of Ephraim. So he's buried in the hill country of Ephraim among his brothers. But what the second section of the prologue does is it introduces that downward spiral of sin and rebellion that we mentioned a little while ago. If you go read chapter 2, verse 6 through chapter 3, verse 6, you'll see a pattern that emerges throughout the main body of the book of Israel sinning, Israel being punished for their rebellion by being handed over to an oppressor, Israel crying out to the Lord, asking him to save them from their oppressor, the Lord raising up a deliverer called a judge, the death of that judge, and then Israel getting even worse in the next generation. Right, let me read chapter 2, verse 19. You know, so the Lord would raise up a judge, but whenever the judge died, they, that is Israel, turned back and were even more corrupt than their fathers. So chapter 2, verse 19 introduces this downward spiral that happens throughout the rest of the book. And Ephraim is part of that spiral. Ephraim takes part of this spiral so that eventually, by the end of chapter 12, those various blessings that we talked about with Ephraim back in Genesis and again in Deuteronomy end up being lost. They lose their realm, their sons are destroyed, and they lose their status among the tribes of Israel.
Mm. Well, there's a lot packed in just to the prologue for Ephraim. But what are, you know, from a very high level, what are some of the big encounters and images of Ephraim and their interactions in the main narrative from about chapter 3 through 16?
Well, there's three major episodes concerning Ephraim in the main narrative. And those episodes are in chapter 3, verses 27 to 29 with Ehud. They're in chapter 7, verse 24 to chapter 8, verse 3 with Gideon. And they're in chapter 12, verses 1 to 6 with Jephthah. There is an interspersed one there that I'll introduce for everyone when I get there. But I think that in terms of Ephraim, the narrative with Ehud kind of provides the pattern for what was supposed to be going on with the people of Ephraim. Ehud, he's the second judge in the book of Judges. And so he's pretty early on in our downward spiral of spiritual disintegration. So we can expect him to be a little bit better than his later counterparts. But Ephraim is introduced at the very end of the narrative. You know, Ehud goes out, he stabs Eglon, And he goes and he sounds the shofar, the trumpet, in the hill country of Ephraim, and he summons the Ephraimites and also all the sons of Israel to battle against Moab and Eglon. And I think what Ehud does in the hill country of Ephraim by doing this is illustrative of the tribes of Ephraim, the tribes of Israel, including Ephraim, working together. So that Ehud would go and he would sound the trumpet call to warfare from Ephraim and brings all the sons of Israel together, as he says in verse 27 and 28, is illustrating that tribal cooperation from the prologue. Now, Ehud is a good judge in this sense in calling the sons of Israel together for war. And one of the things that ends up happening throughout the later narratives is that I think Gideon and Jephthah are going to be juxtaposed to Ehud. We'll see that more as we get there. But immediately after Ehud in this sort of paradigmatic role of Ephraim and all of Israel being gathered together in the hill country of Ephraim to make war against Canaan, there's another narrative that has Ephraim in it in Judges 4 and 5. This one's not a major narrative with Ephraim, but I think it introduces an important narrative context for what happens with Gideon and Jephthah. And it's in the Barak narrative in Judges 4 and 5, not Jonathan Barak, but Barak.
Right, right.
Yeah. Ephraim is introduced in the Barak narrative in two places, in Judges chapter 4, verse 5, and in chapter 5, verse 14. And both of these episodes illustrate tribal unity. See, in Judges 4, verse 5, Deborah, who's a prophetess, is seen to having all the sons of Israel coming together and joining in Ephraim to hear the word of the Lord. I think that's a positive illustration. But more important for our purposes is in the Song of Deborah in chapter 5. Now, a couple of scholars have argued that this Song of Deborah is in fact a polemic song, a polemical song that's meant to praise tribal cooperation. That it, what it's meant to do is to praise the tribes that join Barak in his war efforts and to confront the tribes that don't. We see this in chapter 5, verses 15 to 17, where that very thing happens. But what's important for us is chapter 5, verse 14. Because in chapter 5, verse 14, Ephraim is among the tribes that are praised for their joining Barak in the war effort and going to fight as the sons of Israel together against their Canaanite oppressors. See, what this narrative does is it introduces an aspect to the book of Judges where Ephraim is seen to have this mindset where they're praised for joining their fellow Israelites in war. They're praised for going in. Even that Deborah is, you know, judging, she's a prophetess in Ephraim, shows that one of the key aspects of the tribe of Ephraim at this point was to emphasize tribal unity. They were the place where Ehud called all the sons of Israel together. They're the place where Deborah, the prophetess, would prophesy to all the sons of Israel together, and Ephraim would readily go to war with Barak against their Canaanite neighbors. So that sets an important stage for what happens with Gideon. See, Gideon in chapter 7, verses 24 and 25, and into chapter 8, verse 3, doesn't engage in this type of tribal unity. In fact, he, unlike Ehud, who calls Ephraim and all of Israel together in the hill country of Ephraim to war right off the bat whenever he's ready to go against Moab, Gideon waits to the very end of the battle to call Ephraim out to join him in warfare. And what ends up happening is this sets up a context where Ephraim confronts Gideon for his failure to call him out to begin with. And I think that that's not as bad as commentators make it out to be. You know, generally, you'll go pick up a commentator and they'll say something to the effect of Ephraim as just being self-centered, they're being self-righteous. They just wanted to be the center of attention, and they're mad at Gideon for not making them the center of attention. But what I'm saying is that Ephraim is in fact frustrated with Gideon for not following the paradigm of Ehud.
Mm.
Frustrated with Gideon because what he does in not calling Ephraim and the sons of Israel together for war goes against the praise that was proclaimed to Ephraim in chapter 5, verse 14, for their actions in joining other tribes to make war against the Canaanites. So essentially what this accusation is they're approaching a judge and saying, come on, Gideon, why aren't you joining the people of Israel together? Why aren't you joining together the tribes? Why aren't you a deliverer for all of Israel? Why aren't you calling us together? And I think that the narrative makes that point very clearly, because Gideon calls Ephraim to join the battle. And what happens? Ephraim immediately goes out in chapter 7, verses 24 and 25, and they do what Gideon asked. Now, if Ephraim was really self-centered, self-righteous, and mad at Gideon for not calling him out to begin with because he offended, you know, this honor that they wanted, that's not how it would have played out. You know, if you ask your kid, you know, say, all right, son, go clean the room. What doesn't happen is they obey you, and then they come back and they say, hey, you know, that really wasn't a fair thing that you asked me to clean my room later instead of earlier. Now, that didn't make a lot of sense. They would complain, and then you would force them to go and clean the
room. Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, same way with Ephraim here, that they immediately go and they obey Gideon, I think calls into question the thesis that all that they have going on is a sort of self-centered, self-righteous, why isn't the focus all on Ephraim's stance? And this plays out also in, well, before I carry on with that, I do want to say that even though Ephraim had a point, right, they have a point that Gideon should have been bringing the people together in his war effort. I think the way that they go about doing it is almost just as bad. That, you know, I say in the paper that although Ephraim had a point, the manner in which they go about confronting Ephraim may actually serve to further the problem. So Ephraim comes up, and I say to Gideon, what is this that you have done to us? Now, you can already tell the kind of pointed nature of it in English. It's like, what are you doing, Gideon? Why have you done this thing to us, not to include us in your war efforts? But what we, you know, kind of miss in translation is other parallels of this sort of phrase in the Bible and in the ancient Near East of this actually being a summons to battle. Now, you know, this sort of phrase is you're confronting another leader, you're confronting another king, and the issue is so severe that you're pretty much telling them, we're at the brink of war.
Yeah, this is like a formula here that we don't necessarily recognize as English speakers.
Right, yeah. It's kind of a formula, and the stage is set for war. Now, I do think that in the Gideon narrative, you know, we're talking about chapter 8, verses 1 to 3 now, that this accusation and this confrontation by Ephraim is a step back from we're going to war, period. And I think that because of the way that the narrator describes their conflict. See, right after Ephraim says, what is this thing that you have done to us? The narrator describes to us that that they accused him fiercely. Now, in the Hebrew, this is a particular word, and that word is reef. Now, you don't got to know Hebrew. I'll describe it to you. But the importance of this word is that it's a verbal complaint. You know, a reeve is something that's it's a more legal term. It's something that you would see in a courtroom type of context. Now, the narrator describing it that way is saying that this accusation from Ephraim, although severe, is still on the level of a verbal accusation. You know, they're not quite ready to go full scale into war against Gideon. So although there's an aspect of this complaint that we would say is far too severe for what Ephraim's trying to do, it's also not, you know, just a self-centered, self-righteous sort of thing, as most other commentators are saying what's going on here. And instead, it's a little bit mixed. And this is no surprise to us because of the downward spiral of the Book of Judges. You know, if Ehud is, and Ephraim in that narrative is pictured as overall good, then two steps later, you know, we pass through the Barak narrative on that, and we get to Gideon, kind of the dead center of this downward spiral. It doesn't surprise us that Ephraim might have a bit of a point, and that while simultaneously going about it in the wrong way. You know, this sort of mixed perception of Ephraim, I don't think is any surprise in light of this downward spiral of the Book of Judges. Now, so Ephraim is confronting Gideon with this context where the praise that they once got for joining up in this conflict with other tribes is being neglected by Gideon. But the downward spiral of Judges isn't just on the part of the people, it's also on the part of the judge. And part of this downward disintegration is the increasing faithlessness of the judge. And I think this is an important aspect of the Gideon narrative. You think back to Judges chapter 6. You know, Gideon is this guy who, for lack of a better point, lacks faith. You know, throughout that entire chapter, he keeps testing the Lord. You know, how could I, you know, be the one to go and do this? And he keeps testing the Lord, And that continues all the way through into chapter 7. And so Gideon has already been seen as this judge who lacks faith. But this, you know, decreasing faithfulness of the judge, you know, it's not saying that they don't have faith, that it's decreasing, has a correspondent aspect where the judge becomes more and more self-centered. The judge becomes more and more concerned for their own glory and for their own prospects than for the things of the Lord and then for the people. And I think this also plays out in the Gideon narrative. Now, so Ephraim comes and they complain to Gideon, the judge. They say, "What is this thing that you have done to us? And then Gideon responds. And he responds saying, "What have I done in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape of Abiezer?" You know, Gideon's from the house of Abiezer. And then he says, "God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. What have I done in comparison with you?" A lot of commentators look at this and they see this as a prime expression of, you know, a good politician who, you know, he appeases the people with a nice soft word, which ties in well with their thesis that Ephraim is, you know, just self-centered and self-praising. But this is also something I call into question as I work through my paper. And I do it by looking at the narrative following chapter 8, verse 3. Because if you look at the narrative in chapter 8, verse 4 and following, what ends up happening is Gideon engages Midian in a parallel manner as Ephraim engaged them in chapter 7, verses 24 and 25. Let me illustrate that really fast. In chapter 7, verses 24 and 25, so Gideon summons Ephraim. They come out against Midian, and what do? They cross over the Jordan River. They capture two princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, and then they kill these two princes, Oreb and Zeb. Well, then you flip over and you look at chapter 8, verse 4, through the end of chapter 8, verse 21. And what does Gideon do? He crosses over the Jordan. He pursues after not princes, but kings of Midian. He captures the kings of Midian, and then he kills the kings of Midian. In fact, if you're looking at the Hebrew, the exact same words are used for the pattern for Ephraim's work as they're crossing over the Jordan, and then also for Gideon's work as he's going on his own sort of narrative rampage in chapter 8, verses 4 through 21. So what I think is going on there is that Ephraim, or not Ephraim, but Gideon, is in fact answering his own question in chapter 8, verses 1 to 3. Remember, he says, "What have I done compared to you, Ephraim?" But now in chapter 8, verses 4 to 21, he goes and he tries to one up the tribe of Ephraim. If Ephraim went and captured the princes of Midian, here goes Gideon. He's going to capture the kings of Midian. You know, if they are going to pursue after Oreb and Zeb, I will capture the kings. He's going after his own sort of glory here. He is answering his question, "What have I done compared to you?" And he's going to say, "You've caught princes. I am going to get the kings. I will get the glory." And I think this is highlighted not only from what Gideon does, but also his interaction with two cities while he's on this sort of pursuit. Now, so Gideon, he's going, he's crossing over the Jordan River. He is pursuing after the kings of Midian, just like Ephraim pursued after the princes of Midian. He's going to capture them, but as he's on the way, he has some confrontations with two different cities. He has confrontations with Succoth and Penuel. And the confrontations that he has with Succoth and Penuel are actually patterned after his confrontation with Ephraim. And as we'll see, both on the side of Gideon the judge and on the side of Succoth and Penuel, the people, the downward spiral begins to speed up. You know, it increases as they're going down this. And it happens when, you know, Gideon's on his pursuit. And the first thing that we see in chapter 8, verse 5, is that Gideon is incessant. You know, he is going to go and he is going to get these kings. Notice how he describes his, how the first interaction with Succoth is described. He approaches the city and he requests bread, not for himself. It's very clear in the text. It's not for himself. It's for his men. What does he say? He says, "They are exhausted." And then this is emphatic in the Hebrew, "but I am pursuing." His men are exhausted. I am pursuing. Gideon is incessant. He is going. He will get these kings no matter what. But also notice the manner that the leaders of Succoth and then also Penuel respond. You see, Gideon placates Ephraim by highlighting that Oreb and Zeb have been given into their hands. But what does Succoth say? Well, see, they say, you know, in responding to Gideon's approach asking for bread, they say, "Are the kings of Midian in your hands?" Now imagine a guy who's incessantly pursuing this glory. He's trying to one up the men of Ephraim that have just confronted him. And here's Succoth kind of poking the bear. You know, "Are they in your hands? What have you done that we should give bread for your men, Gideon?" You know, it's kind of this, it's kind of a direct attack on Gideon. "What have you done that we would follow you?" And then Gideon responds, he's saying, "Well, I'm gonna go get them in my hand. When I come back, you're going to get it. I'm going to whip you with thorns and thistles." You know, that's from Gideon's side. But notice also from the side of Succoth and Penuel. Ephraim, when Gideon went to them with their request, how did they respond? Positively. They initially went out and they did exactly what Gideon asked them to do. Not so with Succoth and Penuel. As Gideon, their leader, goes up to them, they refuse to do what he says. And then also again with Gideon's response, with Ephraim, he placates them verbally. But notice what happens with Succoth. You know, he goes to the city with Succoth. They refuse to give him bread. And he says, "When I do get this authority, when I do secure the kings of Midian into my hand. I'm going to come back, and I'm going to whip you with thistles. Narrative carries on. Same thing happens at Penuel. He goes up. They say the same thing as the men with Succoth, but this time he's not going to just whip them with thorns and with thistles. He's going to kill them. So this sort of narrative is actually developing from Ephraim's confrontation. What happens by the end of it is that a progression has occurred from a verbal placation of Gideon, of Ephraim by Gideon, to a whipping with thorns at Succoth, and ultimately death at Penuel. So this whole narrative kind of highlights, you know, this downward disintegration of relationships between the tribe and between their leader, and also even between tribes themselves, as Ephraim is not called out. So what's going on here is that as Gideon seeks to secure into his own hand a prize greater than the Ephraimites, he answers his own rhetorical question, "What have I done compared to you?" And he answers it by one-upping him. So that by chapter 8, verse 22, the men of Israel say what to Gideon? They recognize that he's secured into his own hand the leaders of Midian, and they say, "Come and rule over us." You know, Gideon has secured the glory for the victory over the Midianites. Now, so far, both from the side of Gideon the judge and from the side of the people, there's been a growing disintegration between these two parties. And even from the side of the people, there's been a growing failure in intertribal cooperation in war. And these things come up again in the Jephthah narrative in chapter 12, verses 1 to 6. Because chapter 12, verses 1 to 6 is actually built off of 8:1 to 3 and 3:27 to 29. I wish I could post these charts that I know you, both of you, are able mm-hmm. to see. But I think I can say it verbally. Chapter 3, verses 28 to 29 is parallel to chapter 12, verses 4 to 6. But chapter 12, verses 1 to 3 is parallel to chapter 8, verses 1 to 3. So what we have in chapter 12 is joining together of the Ahud and Gideon narratives in this new confrontation with Jephthah. So whereas what happens is the confrontation between Ephraim and Gideon is paralleled in Ephraim and Jephthah. But then what happens in chapter 12, verses 4 to 6, is that Jephthah's slaughter of the Ephraimites is parallel to Ahud's slaughter of the Moabites. See, in line with this downward spiral, you know, both of those sides of it are going to increase. You know, for example, Ahud kills 10,000 Moabites. How many Ephraimites are killed by Jephthah? 42,000. Mm. You know, it's this increase or maybe decrease in the situation, progression downward. And a progression towards more and more sin. But the first element in this sort of progressive deterioration is seen in the confrontation in chapter 8, verses 1 to 3. And notice what happens. You know, in the confrontation with Gideon, Ephraim's mad that they weren't summoned up at all. With Gideon, Ephraim's mad that they weren't summoned up at the beginning of the battle. But with Jephthah, they weren't summoned up at all. And so even though Gideon has, you know, this tribal cooperation as sort of an afterthought, Jephthah couldn't care less. And so Ephraim confronts him, and they use almost the same sort of language as they did with Gideon. They say, "Why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites and did not call us to go with you?" This is the same sort of battle summons as chapter 8, verses 1 to 3. In fact, in the Hebrew, they're almost exactly parallel, if you look at those charts that I sent to both of you guys. However, in the Gideon narrative, the narrator qualified it for us. He said this is a verbal complaint. It's a reeve. But notice that that's not what happens in chapter 12. No longer is it a verbal complaint, but Ephraim continues. And they say, we're going to bring your house down. Now, we're going to burn your house over with fire. See, by this point, Ephraim's confrontation should be seen as they're going to war, period. Now, there's no question. It's a direct statement of war. And that statement of war from Ephraim's side is highlighted also from Jephthah's response. You see, Jephthah's response is actually also a sort of paradigm calling out for war. And the interesting thing is that his response in chapter 12, verses 2 to 3, is set over against how he handled a situation back in chapter 11. See, in chapter 11, Israel is in conflict with Ammon. And Jephthah is brought up by the people as their deliverer. And what Jephthah does with them is he engages in a reeve. In fact, if you go and you read chapter 11, the majority of that chapter is a letter that Jephthah wrote to the Ammonites trying to settle this dispute verbally, trying to settle this dispute in court. His dispute with Ammon, he describes as a reeve. It eventually fails and it goes into combat, but that's not what he does with his own brothers, with his own fellow tribe. He doesn't even try to have this verbal response. Instead, he immediately responds with a battle challenge of his own. And verses 2 to 3, that's what we have. He confronts them. He's saying, you know what? You're going to come to me to a battle challenge. I'm going to confront you with a battle challenge. In fact, there's an article. The guy's last name is Cutler, that argues that these parallel phrases between Ephraim and Jephthah and also Ephraim back with Gideon are actually kind of paradigms in the entire ancient Near East. Like these, mm-hmm. This is how a battle would begin, you know, in battle narratives throughout the ancient Near Eastern world. But Jephthah's response to Ephraim, so Ephraim comes up and they say, why didn't you call us up to go with you? What does he say? He says, and I mentioned this earlier, the first thing he says, I and my people. The I and my of Jephthah is contrasted to the with you of Ephraim's complaint. You see, Jephthah is saying, this is my deal. You have no claim here, Ephraim. You should have nothing to do with this warfare. Why is this even a complaint? It's as though Judges chapter 5, verse 14 is so much of an afterthought that it doesn't even matter anymore. You know, why would you complain that you weren't called to join me in war? It's kind of an affront to the earlier narratives where that intertribal cooperation was praised. You know, if in chapter 1, verses 22 to 26, if in chapter 3, verses 27 to 29, and chapter 5, verse 14, that intertribal cooperation was praised and seen as kind of a paradigm that should be followed through the rest of the book, by chapter 12, the guy that was supposed to be the deliverer of Israel is just brushing all of that away and saying, you know, why would you even come up? Why would you bring this up at all? So what ends up happening, you know, Jephthah responds to Ephraim with his own battle challenge, and he goes up and war begins to ensue in chapter 12, verses 4 to 6. Jephthah gathers up all the men of Gilead and they go to fight against the Ephraimites. Now, as I mentioned earlier, this battle narrative in chapter 12, verses 4 to 6 is directly parallel to the Ahab narrative in chapter 3, verses 27 to 29. The key difference being that whereas Ahab had the Ephraimites and all of Israel secure the fords of the Jordan, preventing anyone from crossing over in order to strike an oppressor of Israel, Jephthah gathers up his forces, secures the fords of the Jordan, prevents Ephraim from crossing over, and it leads to the destruction of 42,000 Ephraimites. See, as this downward spiral is continuing, the warfare that Israel was supposed to wage against their enemies is turning inward. The harem warfare, the warfare they were supposed to engage in against the Canaanites, is now being turned where they're waging war against themselves. The conquest has been traded for civil war. The end of Jephthah's confrontation of Ephraim ends in what has been termed the Shibboleth incident. And what happens in the Shibboleth incident, it's pretty easy to understand, so you can go and you can read it for yourself. But what I want to emphasize on the show is that the term Shibboleth is a synonym that means one of two things, and I think both of them are in play in this narrative. See, Shibboleth can either mean ear of corn or streams and river.
Hmm.
Now, Shibboleth as an ear of corn is used most in Genesis chapter 41. Now, Genesis 41 is where Ephraim is born and named. And Shibboleth occurs 10 times in Genesis chapter 41 and only four other times in the rest of the entire Old Testament. So this, this constellation of Shibboleth in Genesis 41 recalls the fruitfulness of Ephraim. So that Gilead, he approaches, the people of Gilead led by Jephthah approach Ephraim at the waters of the Jordan, and they say Shibboleth. And that should recall for us Ephraim's naming as fruitfulness.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that they're doing this at the fords of the Jordan recalls the much less used homonym meaning streams or rivers. So what I think Jephthah is having them do here is pretty ingenious. He's confronting Ephraim's namesake. He's confronting their fruitfulness with the waters of the Jordan. And in fact, if you went and looked at all the places where Shibboleth is used as a river or as a stream, it's used in that same sort of context. It's used in reference to its destructive force. In fact, the main place, it's used only three times. If you go and look at Psalm 69, the uses of Shibboleth are actually seen in a context that are really similar to the floodwaters. It's like Ephraim is being washed away. Their fruitfulness is being destroyed in the waters of the Jordan.
But that's the same word. So their Shibboleth is destroyed by Shibboleth.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And now throughout this thing, we've talked about, the beginning, how Ephraim was what that meant before the time of the judges. And that had a particular emphasis on them having a fruitful progeny and a fruitful realm and a status, particularly over the tribe of Manasseh. Now, what I haven't brought out yet is that Gideon and Jephthah are both from Manasseh. One from West Manasseh, Gideon, Jephthah from East Manasseh, Gilead, including the area there. So that tribal cooperation in chapter 1, verses 22 to 26 of the house of Joseph is undone in the narrative. And in fact, in chapter 12, after the house of Manasseh has effectively destroyed the house of Ephraim, and just a few verses later in chapter 12, verse 15, Ephraim loses the land. See, chapter 12, verse 15, it's talking about Ephraim again. Up to this point in the narrative, the land of Ephraim had been referenced as the hill country of Ephraim. But listen to chapter 12, verse 15. Abdon, the son of Hillel, a minor judge in the book, died and was buried in the land of Ephraim, and then it's qualified the hill country of the Amalekites. The loss of their fruitfulness, the loss of their progeny, led to the loss of their land. In chapter 12, verse 15. and that it was done by Manasseh has undone all of those three main threads of promise of Ephraim before the time of the judges. I think we can go from there.
Yeah, no, that's quite significant that it's Manasseh, just to bring us all the way back to their connection through Joseph and the reversal, the supposed reversal of blessing from Jacob. It's quite significant here to see how all this unravels.
You know, all of these fascinating connections within the narrative of the Book of Judges itself, and you know, the kind of important and even, you know, perhaps in a certain way, central role in which the tribe of Ephraim, you know, is playing within the narrative. Moving outside of the book, Will, perhaps even now moving forward in terms of the trajectory of the themes that you've unfolded for us, how does this... the lessons that we've learned here about the Book of Judges, Ephraim's role, the negative and the positive aspects, the inner cooperative or lack thereof nature of the tribes in the land conquest. Moving into the New Testament, moving towards the eschatology, perhaps we might say, of the Book of Judges, how would that be unpacked? How do we understand some of these themes, particularly as Christians standing at the fullness of time?
Yeah. Now, I think all three of us want to affirm that the Book of Judges, on its own terms, looks forward to Christ. Now, the way that it does that could vary from passage to passage. But generally, you know, speaking very generally, what Judges does is it presents the need for a divine deliverer. You know, it kind of shows us that the human work of these various judges is insufficient to the task of ultimate deliverance to come, and that eventually happens in Christ. But in reference to the tribe of Ephraim, there's a lot of places that we can go. It's very prominent. Ephraim is very prominent in the prophetic literature. And I think one of the best places that we can start with is Hosea chapter 11. See, Hosea 11, verses 8 to 9. You know, we've just presented this context where Ephraim is getting judged. You know, they're, because of the sin and rebellion that Israel is going through, that Ephraim is a type of, they're in danger of losing the blessings of the covenant. Insert into that context Hosea chapter 11, verses 8 and 9, where the Lord says, "How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not a man. I am the Holy One in your midst." And as both of you know, and maybe some of our readers know, Hosea 11 is picked up in the New Testament, especially Hosea chapter 11, verse 1, "Out of Egypt I called my son," which is applied to Christ in Matthew chapter 2, verse 15, right? Matthew 2, 15. Now that it's tied together, this promise of Ephraim not being given up, of the Lord pouring out his compassion for them, is tied together in a prophetic fulfillment of the Lord sending his own son that he brings up out of the land of Egypt in the person and work of Christ. Now, that's, you know, a general way to go about it. There's more particular ways we can do it as well. Ephraim in the book of Isaiah is set parallel with Samaria. In fact, Isaiah chapter 9, verse 9 is an example of that. But then Ephraim and Samaria are kind of both terms related to the northern kingdom. We can also start thinking of the book of Acts and how, because of the work of Christ and the pouring out of the Spirit at Pentecost, the church and the covenant community expands from Judah to Samaria and to the ends of the earth. So, and we can even summarize from Judah to Ephraim and to the ends of the earth. And this expansion is something that is the work of the Spirit. In fact, this joining of Judah and Ephraim, Judah and Samaria, is an aspect of Ezekiel chapter 37. Both of y'all know Ezekiel chapter 37. It's in the context of chapter 36, the Spirit's going to be poured out. There's going to be this new covenant. Beginning in chapter 7, that Spirit wafts over a valley of dry bones, tying the pouring out of the Spirit with resurrection. But that's not where chapter 37 ends. The Spirit is poured out over this valley of dry bones. And then chapter 37, verses 15 to 28, this has a correspondent effect in a union of a single people of the Lord, Judah and Ephraim being brought together by the work of a Davidic shepherd. So this problem where Ephraim continues down this spiral of sin and rebellion and the disintegration of intertribal politics that continues into the monarchic era with the separation of Judah and Ephraim as southern and northern tribes is reconciled by the work of the Spirit and then the final Davidic shepherd that is Jesus Christ, uniting these two again in the one people of the Lord that we see expressed in the life of the church. In Acts chapter 1, verse 8, you know, that the gospel spreading from Judah to Samaria and even to the ends of the earth, uniting a single people by the power of the Spirit to Christ, uniting Judah and Ephraim, and even grafting in Gentiles as a wild branch.
Yeah. That's so helpful. I mean, and we start to think of the biblical theological connections of a book like Judges. If we were to not read Judges that way, we could certainly see how people would preach it in a way, or first off, most people wouldn't preach it ever because they don't see any real application in the text. Or if they do, they would do it merely in some form of moralistic or exemplary type of mode. And if they can't find, you know, a positive role model in some of these characters, then it would merely be the anti-exemplary approach, all of which are unsatisfactory. And we certainly have to understand Judges within the context of all of Scripture so that we can understand it rightly. And when we do read it and interpret it in light of all of Scripture, we see its purpose and significance and how it does drive us to Christ in a unique way and how it opens up for us many other themes and understanding. So, I mean, it's very significant here. I appreciate what you've done in building this case, Will. I know we've only really scratched some of the surface of what's in the paper, but perhaps we can make some of these resources available, and if you end up doing something with the paper in the future, we can certainly make it available to people, online. But in the meantime, is there a way that our listeners could perhaps get in touch with you, Will? Should they do it through the comment section on the website, or do you have an email or some other way that you'd prefer to be contacted?
Yeah, if they put a comment on there, or you can put them in touch with me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, either. Yeah, it doesn't.
I'm sure the listeners will have many questions and want to follow up on much of the material. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can visit us online at reformedforum.org. Certainly we'll have a comment thread going for this episode. You can also send us an email at mail@reformedforum.org. You'll certainly find many resources available online, going back and looking at some of our other subjects in the Old Testament, as well as Will's previous episode on a biblical theology of clothing. But I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.